It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a checkup on what's happening in Congress with USA Today's Paul Singer.
But first, many of us woke up this morning to reports of the Heartbleed bug, a glitch in the online encryption software that's supposed to protect our personal data, banking, info, and passwords.
Cybersecurity experts say this bug could affect more than 500,000 websites and allow hackers to steal our private data or impersonate us online.
So what is the Heartbleed bug and how can we protect ourselves against it? We've asked Nate Vack, a research programmer at the University of Wisconsin, to explain. Nate, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing well, thanks. Well, the Heartbleed bug is all the talk this morning, especially in web security circles and among users. What is it?
So it is a bug by which hackers can download little pieces of data from web servers. They can't choose what data they're downloading, but they can just say, give me a little bit. And maybe that contains passwords or credit card numbers or things that let you log into websites, essentially.
And this is a vulnerability that some in the know have been aware of for a little while. It's just come out to the general public. What is the vulnerability within the software? What happens there?
So in the security communications protocol, there is something you can do called a heartbeat where you say, hey, just send some data back to me. I'm going to send you 1,000 bytes of data. Send me 1,000 bytes back. But really, you only send it 1 byte. And the server gets confused and just sends you 999 other bytes from somewhere that it knows about. It's a crapshoot what you get. So it's really weird.
So, hackers can't go in and say, I want to pull Veronica's credit card number. It's just sort of random what they get out of it.
Absolutely. So the data, one of the things that is really frustrating about this is this doesn't leave any traces in anybody's logs. It just looks like ordinary traffic to the rest of the world. So nobody can know how long people have been doing this. This bug, we've only known about it for a few weeks, but it's existed for 2 years. So there could have been evil people out there exploiting this for years and years, just downloading data, and we would never know. But again, nobody can go in and say, I want your data, Veronica, I want your data, Nate, and steal that.
So how widespread is the SSL encryption stuff that is being vulnerable right now to Heartbleed?
So SSL encryption backs everything that you do on the Internet that is secure. The good news is this isn't a design flaw. This is an implementation flaw. This is a bug in one specific kind of SSL software. The bad news is that it's a really popular one. It's one of the free ones that's used almost everywhere. So anything running on a modern Linux server, which, if you're a customer, you have no idea what is running on your website of choice. But it's not everything. And it's probably not even half or not even more than half.
A lot of times we'll be on a website, maybe doing some secure shopping, we think, and a little padlock will show up by the URL. And we assume that this means that what we're doing is safe, that it is private.
Yes.
So should we not be assuming that anymore?
Well, privacy is always relative, right? It's very private in general. It's not trivial by any means to just download all of this data to break that privacy completely. One of the other risks that this bug has is there is a way for people to, by downloading all the memory on the server, find out how it's doing that encryption. And then if that person can intercept your traffic, can also see what you're sending to and from that server, then it can read everything as it goes over the network, over a wireless network or such. That's really unlikely to happen on a widespread level and would be something that is very targeted in general because intercepting a lot of traffic is very hard.
Can you give us a sense of some of the big sites that might be most affected by this?
I know that Yahoo was affected for a long time, or not a long time. I know it's been affected for a long time because it's been 24 hours. I believe Google and other, most people running any significant number of servers has something that is affected by this. And it's been interesting to see what services have sent me emails saying, hey, you should change your passwords. You should do X, Y, and Z. And that number has been a lot smaller than I expected, and I don't know quite what to make of that.
All right. Well, so speaking of changing your password and or freaking out, should we be doing both those things?
I wouldn't freak out about this. I would freak out if you're running a website. If you are running a website, you should not be listening to this radio show. You should be fixing your servers right now. But if you are, what I would do, honestly, is look at the emails that you've gotten from the services that you use. And if they say, hey, we think you should update your you should change your password, or we think something has been leaked, then take the actions they recommend.
And if you haven't gotten any emails, should you just stay the course and hope for the best?
You know, I don't know exactly what else you can do. You could go and change your password everywhere, but that is kind of insane. One thing that's very important in general, and this kind of reinforces, is using the same password, using the same login and password on a whole lot of websites is a bad idea, because if one of these websites gives it up somehow, then people can get into all of your other websites. So if you've been thinking about, should I try one of those password manager things that lets me use a different password everywhere I go, now is a good time to do that.
And I understand that there are some programs now that will help you manage multiple passwords. I mean, the reason people use their pet's name for every login is that it's convenient and they can remember it. But
yeah.
You're saying get over that and maybe use one of these other tools for managing it.
Yeah, 1Password is a really common one that people like a lot. Apple has some stuff built into its thing. I will admit that I'm not very good about this, and I use a throwaway password on a lot of websites. So now you know.
Now it's out there. Well, is this going to be a wake-up call for people that there are vulnerabilities? Maybe there always will be. We'll be waiting for the next shoe to drop. Maybe it's time, for instance, for tech companies to beef up their encryption software, too.
Even more than that, it is time to really think about how people architect stuff and to really think about, okay, does this server really need to know all of this information? Can we minimize the amount of data that we lose in the event of a breach, which is inconvenient because it's expensive to do that. It's easier to put everything on one box in general or not think about those things. But it is also risky as it lets little innocuous problems build on each other and get out of hand.
Nate, anything else we can do aside from changing our passwords to protect ourselves both from this Heartbleed bug and anything else that might be coming down the pike?
You know, if you're really interested in checking if a website is vulnerable to the Heartbleed bug, you can just search for Heartbleed Tester on Google. And I'm not going to try and read web addresses over the phone because it's ridiculous. But you'll find some things that you just enter a web address and it will check and see, hey, is this site affected? And then just, you know, always, I guess it's always worth thinking about what information you're giving to who when. Because even in a world where all of the technology works perfectly, when you're giving your data to a website, you have to trust that the people running that website are trustworthy, good people. And it's really easy to forget that, you know, behind all those computers, there are people who you have to trust, too.
That's right. So it's not just the computers on their own. There are people behind, and people are vulnerable. So,
yeah.
Nate, thank you so much for joining us. You've given us some ideas, and I guess we'll just be waiting to see what happens next. We appreciate your time.
Well, thanks for having me.
That was Nate Vack, a research programmer at the University of Wisconsin and co-founder and hacker-in-chief of an internet startup called Gimlet. And we posted the website to check if you've been affected on our Facebook page.
It's time now for our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. Yesterday, Congresswoman Jackie Speier from California introduced a bill that would require members of the House of Representatives to take sexual harassment training. It's something the Senate already does, not the House.
And on Monday, the Senate passed an extension of the long-term unemployment benefits that expired at the end of last year. Their revival has been contentious on Capitol Hill, sometimes seeming likely, other times not so much. And now it's up to the House to decide its fate.
And Democrats raised more money than Republicans last month in the Senate midterm election race. Paul Singer joins us now to talk about all these issues. He's with us every week at this time to look at the inner workings of Congress. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rob. I'm busy changing my passwords at the moment.
Yeah. Hurry up and do that or not. I'm still not quite sure. So as I mentioned, Congresswoman Speier proposed this requirement that everyone in the House would have to take sexual harassment training.
I think it's unnecessary. They seem to be perfectly well-trained in how to sexually harass people.
Ouch. Oh.
You know, this is all a fallout from this congressman, Vance McAllister, who is a freshman from Louisiana, who was caught on a surveillance tape making out with one of his staffers, which is not bad unless, of course, in this case, the congressman happens to be married, as well as having run his campaign on a very sort of Christian conservative platform. So it's bad for him, and it just looks bad for the Congress. And they do this every couple of years. Somebody on Capitol Hill starts, you know, dating a staffer, cheating on their spouse, grabbing people they shouldn't be grabbing. And we go through this whole process of a conversation about, oh, we should have sexual harassment training. Like, no, you should be better human beings.
Well, the Senate has been doing this training, not the House. Do you know why the Senate got it, the House didn't?
Well, I mean, first of all, the Senate is smaller, and it's easier to do, you know, kind of one-on-one training with folks. The other thing is that even in the Senate, it's kind of ad hoc. I mean, they both chambers have, you know, sort of training, particularly for new members. They get through a whole bunch of management training, how to set up an office. And keep in mind that each of these congressional offices operates like a separate business, a separate small business. It's particularly true in the House. So what trainings they get and how they implement them and what their sort of policies are, workplace policies are really dependent on each congressional office. There is no sort of overseer of the entire body.
This isn't a new issue, right? I mean, this is something that I would suspect has gone on for centuries and maybe is only now being viewed as a big problem?
I'm not even sure that's true. I mean, without slandering anybody improperly, I believe it was Senator Bob Packwood who 25 years ago was, you know, forced out because of, you know, improper relations with women. There have been members of Congress for years who've been forced out or forced to step down. And keep in mind, in most of these cases, you're not talking about violations of law. What you're talking about is violations of sort of human rights and human interactions, and it's a public humiliation. People don't like being represented in Congress by folks who do this stuff.
This is a Democrat bringing this up after a scandal involving a Republican. Is the partisan issue there significant?
Not really. I mean, I think obviously the Democrats are going to make hay out of this one. You know, next week it'll be a Democrat. Don't worry about it.
And a lot of the reporting on this has mentioned the former congressman, Democratic congressman, and now former mayor of San Diego, who had massive sexual harassment problems of his own.
Right. And, you know, don't forget Anthony Weiner, one of our favorites, who was sending sexually inappropriate tweets to people. You know, I mean, there's all kinds of ways to do this wrong, and Congress frequently finds those ways.
So is this a law that would have to pass, or is this something that House leadership could just say, hey, this is the new rule?
If it's a law that's going to pass, it's not going to happen. So then you can get to – I mean, the Congress can pass its own rules, but even that, keep in mind that when Congress passes new rules, they pass them as if they're laws. At the beginning of every session, they have to vote on them. So – you know, it really, again, it comes down to public humiliation. And I think, I mean, my suspicion is, and this is strictly suspicion, I have not reported on this much, that, like, this guy McAllister is probably going to get a lot of pressure now from Republican leaders to just go away. Again, it's not a formal rule. It's just they don't want this around.
Well, turning to legislation in Congress, we saw the Senate passing benefits for the long-term unemployed, back and forth on this for a long time now. Now it goes to the House. The president is saying, hey, House, pass this thing. What's going to happen there, do you think?
Well, they're pretty uninterested in passing it in the House for a couple of reasons. You know, one thing to keep in mind, now these benefits have been lapsed since December, and the short-term reinstatement would be a five-month reinstatement through basically the end of May. But, of course, we're getting up close to the end of May, so by the time they pass this bill, they're going to have to extend it again. And the House Republicans, their primary concern is that this is not paid for in any way. There's no offsets. There's no other provision in here to sort of create jobs. They're looking for, is there a way to do some sort of a tax credit or something else that would be a job creation portion or offsetting the cost of this benefit rather than simply being, you know, I think it's what, $10 billion worth of just direct aid. I don't see a great deal of enthusiasm for bringing this up in the House.
And that line of argument is pretty much the same as it was months ago, right? Democrats say this is an economic necessity. People are out of work. Republicans say, lovely, but we need to pay for it. And let's work in the job creation element.
Correct. Yeah, you will hear this over and over again. And again, even if the debate doesn't change, Democrats think this argument works in their favor because it makes them look like they are the ones who are helping the working man, and Republicans are opposing. So even if the House Republicans don't take it up, the Democrats will pass it again, just to make the point.
And is that a point then that they'll wave around in election ads and that sort of thing?
Sure is.
Do you think there's that much at stake for Republicans for not passing it, though? They can just say, hey, this is consistent with our views on spending and job creation.
Right. And I think they've made that bet at this point that stuff like this, it's a short-term aid package. It's not a long-term reform. It's not a major social program. This is the kind of thing where they feel like they can safely say, we are taking the conservative smart government stand against the sort of just give away a lot of money stand. And that's sort of the way they will position it. And I think they feel like they are on relatively solid ground there.
So there's a good shot that this will be one of the many things that the Senate and House disagree on, so nothing happens.
That is right. I know. I'm becoming repetitive on your show, but yeah, that's correct.
But reality is being repetitive, I think.
Yes,
you're just reporting
exactly.
It, man. So speaking of those elections, we saw new reports on fundraising, mainly for the race for Senate, the midterm elections going on. Control of the Senate is at stake. Democrats control it right now. Republicans seem increasingly confident, as we've mentioned before, that they can take control. What did we see in the money race there?
Well, you know, all of these reports come out in the next week or so, the sort of quarterly reports for the big political campaigns. And I would warn you to look at all of them a little skeptically, because everyone's going to come out and say, ooh, we got the more money this quarter, and we got the less money last quarter, and we got more. And everyone finds a way to spin this. You know, one side will say, well, we got more money, but yeah, they've got more debt. Oh, yeah, we have more cash on hand. It's all very incremental.
So they're all waving around balance sheets at us.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think, you know, what the real issue for your listeners to keep in mind is that every year more and more and more money flows into this process, into the political process. And the committees, the party committees, are now sort of the shrinking portion of that money. Where the real money is going to start to show up is in these third-party groups, the 501c4, the super PACs, the political, non-political social welfare organizations. I mean, this is where you'll see enormous sums of money spent in particularly competitive races. And so when some of these various committees report, you know, a dollar amount for the quarter, sure, they'll put out a press release saying we did well, but that money is not going to matter much. What's really going to matter is the big outside money come, you know, September and October.
Well, the Supreme Court's Citizens United opinion a few years back opened the door to a lot of the money you were just talking about. How about this new one, the McCutcheon decision from the Supreme Court? Is that going to let more money flow back via the parties now?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting one because the way it works now, you and I, of course, as journalists, don't actually give money to anybody. But if we wanted to, we'd be capped at $123,000 in total donations that we can give to candidates and party committees. What the Supreme Court ruled last week, I guess, is that those caps no longer stand. So now we can keep giving money. So in theory, I can walk into a room and write a check for $1 million, and then just that check gets divided up amongst as many candidates and party committees as will have it. Now, I'm still limited in how much money I can give to any one candidate or any one party committee for that election cycle, but now the caps on my total giving for the cycle are blown. I can salt my money around broadly.
And when it all comes down to it, do you think more money equals more votes?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, it's if you've got $1 billion and I get $1 billion, aren't we still battling over the same, you know, 150 voters? Because again, Mitt Romney was right. 47% of the electorate is pretty much baked in for the Republicans. 47% is also baked in for the Democrats. Those are pretty much, you know, locked in figures for a national race, and in a lot of the states, not far from that either. So there's just a few percentage points in the middle that we're both spending, you know, $500 million to fight over. Are there more votes out there, or is it just we're applying more technology and techniques to squeeze out the last few?
We'll be watching that over the next few months. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. Have a great day.
You too. That's Paul Singer, politics editor at USA Today. He joins us each Wednesday at this time.
We take a look at the Environmental Protection Agency with a guest who saw the agency from the inside. For 25 years, E.G. Vallionados worked in risk evaluation at the EPA, and in a new book, he makes the case that the agency is falling down on the job.
He says outside forces have turned the EPA from an environmental protection agency into a polluter protection agency, and it's having some serious effects, he says, on public safety and the environment.
E.G. Vallionados is the author of the book Poison Spring, The Secret History of Pollution and the EPA. E.G., welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, as we mentioned, you spent 25 years working for the Environmental Protection Agency. Why do you say that the agency has failed Americans?
Because I learned that the hard way. This is exactly what's going on. That is, slowly I began to not talk in interviewing and talking to my colleagues, but by reading the memos and briefings and other papers within the agency, it became obvious to me that the agency was not doing what it was supposed to do, which is to protect our health and the environment. And there are many cases. I focus primarily on pesticides because Rachel Carson had written that wonderful book in 1962, Silent Spring. And 50 years later, unfortunately, we are still in that path. That is, farmers overuse extremely toxic chemicals that have not been really tested honestly to tell us exactly what they do to insects, to honeybees, to us. And yet we are hooked in this kind of a system of spraying and spraying and spraying.
Now, at the heart of your argument and what you say you saw during those 25 years is the notion that the Environmental Protection Agency has been more or less taken over by the interests of the chemical companies themselves rather than existing to serve the American public and the environment. How did that happen? And can you describe a little bit what you think, what you saw?
Yes, I mean, it happened from the very beginning. With Ruckelshaus as the first administrator, down to today with Obama being the president. The industry exerts an inordinate influence, number one, through the White House, through Congress, and number three, directly. That is, industry lobbies talk to EPA staff almost daily. They fund hundreds of trips that this staff takes to universities, to farms, to other places. And there's that intimate connection. And then number two, equally important, we have the political appointees within the EPA. These are people that the president appoints, and they direct the major programs of the EPA. And they, after the president is through with his tenure, then these guys end up going and working for the so-called regulated industry. So the line of communication continues to exist, and they exert a very inordinate influence, usually to make it smooth for the chemicals that they support to get to the market. And another major consideration is that the way these chemicals are tested, in the 20th century at least, EPA discovered plenty of laboratories that were actually making things up. There was a fraudulent tradition in testing. And it may well continue today, I don't know. But that problematic nature of the actual chemical, what it does to us and to the environment, continues to be a great uncertainty. And to me, if you're going to fix the system, you have to prohibit the chemical industry from testing its own chemicals. Those chemicals have to be tested by an independent organization that will be completely removed from the industry, and then they will provide honest reports to EPA so that EPA can make a valid decision.
Now, let's say that a chemical company wants to get a new chemical on the market, wants to get it approved and out there. What kind of process right now does it have to go through to prove that its chemical is safe?
Yes, they go to EPA and they begin to fill out the paperwork and they say, we have this active ingredient and we promise that it's going to kill X insect, which is causing trouble to farmers in wheat, for instance. And then EPA says, fine, you give us a three-month study and see what effects does have on species that is biologically important insects like honeybees, and then what other things you discover. Meanwhile, they allow the chemical industry immediately to register, that is, they approve the use of these chemicals with a very tiny amount of data. Meanwhile, then they ask the chemical industry, the company, to do a two-year study. And then, but meanwhile, that chemical continues to be sold to the farmers. And then the 2 years become 4 years and 6 years. So this is the kind of very, very kind of unstable process, which is pro-industry process to allow very toxic chemicals to come into the market.
So if a company wants to get that chemical out there, they first have to do a three-month study proving the safeness and then a two-year study. Who does the study?
This is the problem. The problem is that they do the study. Either they do the study or they pay a laboratory to do the study. And EPA does not do any studies. The EPA only looks at paper, thousands of pages of paper. And occasionally in the 20th century, when I was there, we had a data audit people that used to go with people from the Federal Drug Administration. They would audit the laboratories. Now, all that audit system has been weakened to the point probably is non-existent. So they trust that the industry is honest. But I already suggested because of actually discovering fraudulent laboratories, there's a tremendous question mark about the validity or the genuine science that these people do in order to prove that their chemical does whatever they say it does.
Now, you say some of these companies use their own laboratories or some of them hire a private laboratory.
Yes.
Are these private laboratories labs that have been proved impartial and have no connection to the industry itself?
They don't. They may or may not have. That's not important. What important is that they actually do the study outside of the government. So the government does not know what goes into the laboratory. And for instance, in the major fraud that EPA discovered in the 60s, the so-called industrial biotest laboratory outside of Chicago, they discovered that this chemical, these people that were testing the chemicals, if they discovered that an animal was developing cancer, they would simply replace the animal with a new animal. This kind of a fraud. They would do a 24-month study for 10 months, and then they would make up the data for the rest of the time. So, and then on the basis of that fraudulent report, EPA would approve. Indeed, the largest selling chemicals to this very day have been in market because of this tradition of fraud. And EPA never got rid of them, despite the fact that they discovered the laboratory that was doing the fraudulent study. And when people ask them, why don't you remove the chemical? Well, they said that this was the largest component of the chemical industry. They didn't want to put most of the chemical industry out of business. And at the same time, they said, we have complementary studies, and then they asked the companies to repeat their studies. Meanwhile, however, you and I kept eating or drinking milk that might have been contaminated with that chemical. That is the problem that we have to solve by not allowing these companies to actually do their own studies. We have to have an independent facility to do the testing so that we put our faith that, in fact, if they say it does not harm the environment, it does not harm the environment.
Now, you mentioned lab animals may be getting cancer. The company may replace that animal with another animal that doesn't have cancer and just proceed. And to talk about cancer, you suggest that, you know, when we go to fight for a cure for cancer, that this is sort of a ridiculous wild goose hunt because really it's the chemicals that are causing the cancer. What sort of evidence do you have that that's true, that it is the chemicals that are causing the cancer epidemic, if you want to call it that?
Because there's a scientific studies outside of the chemical industry that has shown many of these chemicals, like, for instance, DDT and the neonicotinoids they use now to protect their crops. Actually, they are carcinogenic, they are teratogenic, they are some of them are neurotoxins, like the ones that they use now that are killing, wiping out the honeybees. Neonicotinoids are terribly neurotoxin chemicals. And they started with a tradition. I remember in 1974 when EPA registered a neurotoxin known as parathion into nylon microcapsules, about 40 microns diameter, the size that is of a pollen, so that the honeybee would not know what it was picking up, pollen or poison. And the honeybee would return back to its hive, and all the hive would be dead. And I remember my colleagues, the ecologists, were protesting, and I have read, of course, their memos. They were telling their bosses, don't, or at least put a moratorium to discover more about these chemicals. But no, they extended the usage, not just in corn, but in soybeans, in alfalfa, and so on, in other crops. And that tradition fundamentally continues. That is, the industry is number one in the EPA priorities because of the political influence that the White House, the congressional people, plus the industry itself is having.
Now, there has been a pretty big outcry from beekeepers, conservationists, about neonicotinoids that people suspect are decimating the honeybee population. What happens when those people confront the EPA? Sometimes there have been lawsuits and say, you know, we need to ban these. What's going on there?
Yeah, what's going on there? The EPA says, well, we don't have any evidence that, in fact, it wipes out the honeybees. They used to sell that to my colleagues in the 70s and the 80s, and they continue to play the same music. I mean, the evidence is there. I mean, my colleagues would have bring in even pictures of piles and piles of dead honeybees, and that would made no difference, apparently. And the honeybee, the keepers, the beekeepers are very weak. They write letters, they complain, they say, you decimate my honeybees, but no effect.
And did your colleagues speak out and say, we have some reservations, some concerns about these chemicals? And
yes, of course. They did what bureaucrats do. They write memos. They wrote memos to their superiors, citing the evidence, and they gave me copies of all these memos, so that's why I speak the way that I do. And the supervisors simply never bothered to respond to those memos. They simply said, we're going to extend the use of these chemicals to this crop or to other crop, to the other crop. That's why we have reached this tragic moment in our history where extremely valuable insect like honeybee is on the verge of extinction. I mean, they forget that the honeybee pollinates 90 crops in this country, and the crops alone are valued around $40 to $20 billion per year. And yet they care less. I mean, this is, regrettably, that's the politics of greed is overtaking Washington, D.C., and therefore it's overtaking EPA. I mean, EPA is not in isolation. It's part of the larger system of the government. It's part of the economic system, of the crisis we face right now as a society, of the divorce of people from nature. They don't know where their food comes from. Indeed, each time I teach at a college, and I was teaching last year, my students' key question is, where our food is coming from?
And we're talking right now with E.G. Valianatos, who spent 25 years working for the EPA, and he's now speaking out about what he saw there and says the agency is failing Americans and catering to polluters. You can join the conversation with your questions and your comments at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. We're talking with author and former EPA employee E.G. Valianatos. He says the agency has betrayed its mission of protecting Americans, and it's having a devastating effect on public health and the environment.
You can join the conversation. Do you worry about the role the EPA plays in regulating, especially chemicals, pesticides, that sort of thing? Do you have questions about what it was like on the inside working at the Environmental Protection Agency? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
And E.G., I apologize for jumping in on you before we went to the news there. Do you want to finish your thought? You were talking about how your students are wondering where their food comes from.
The problems we face, I mean, they are existential. I mean, I think the environmental crisis is really an existential crisis. Not just global warming, but the kind of questions that we are talking about, that is what we eat, the water we drink, whether they are clean, whether they are polluted, contaminated, and why they have been contaminated for all these decades. Rachel Carson did a fantastic job in 1962, and now we are 2014. Why should we actually be talking about the same thing? And this is the problem of agriculture. Agribusiness is too large. It has devastated, it has emptied the countryside of America. Now I go to the Central Valley and you don't see people. You only see huge, straight expanses of land and no communities. So this process of supporting giant agriculture has been inimical to democracy, and it has been inimical to our own public, to our own health and the environment. So we need to change all that. And EPA is simply one of the major reasons why we are in the predicament we are. And I don't blame EPA directly. I blame the people who influence the agency to be what it is today.
Well, I want to ask you about that. When you saw things going wrong in the agency, when you saw the chemical companies seemed to be having undue influence and chemicals were getting approved that you and your colleagues thought were unsafe, why did you stay? Why didn't you get out and start beating the drum that something was rotten?
I did.
You were there for 25 years.
I did it in my own small way. I mean, I was talking to congressional staff privately, of course. I was talking to people who listen. And I was talking to my own colleagues. And, of course, I was writing my memos. And I sent my memos up, and, you know, the people who run the agency told me that you are not a team player. And if they tell you you're not a team player, you are completely out. They isolate you. They of course, they stop promoting you. I mean, in other words, you pay a price. I mean, I couldn't do more than what I did. They would actually fire me. They did try to fire me once, but they couldn't. So it's you cannot really do very much because the so-called whistleblowers do not have the protection they actually deserve.
Let's go to the phones now. We've got some folks waiting to talk to you. We'll go first to Patrick in Brookfield. Hi, Patrick.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes.
I have both positive and negative experiences with the EPA, and I feel very sympathetic and with the resistance that this gentleman has had trying to do what the evidence tells him he should be doing and the politics involved. I remember one time there was a rule against polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, and they call it the fire rule. And one of the reasons is because when it would decompose, it would create phosgene gas, mm-hmm. and that further tightened the rules for PCBs. However, the phosgene gas came from a component of a mixture with PCBs, and I asked the EPA, why did they not regulate that chemical and just tighten the rules on PCB-filled transformers? The answer was Congress had banned PCBs and had not banned this other chlorinated hydrocarbon. Therefore, they appreciate our efforts to spread the word, but their hands were pretty much tied. So I feel sorry for them in that regard. However, sometimes the EPA goes overboard, like navigable water systems for oil rules, oil spill rules, and they consider prairie potholes under that definition.
And okay, so, well, thank you, Patrick. I think we've got the gist there. And EG, do you want to respond to those different perspectives?
Yeah, I mean, the 1976 EPA did, in fact, I mean, Congress did, in fact, ban PCBs. And PCBs are extremely toxic. They last for decades in the environment. They have known about the toxic nature of these chemicals for decades. And we still find this stuff, and they're still burning them, and they still get them out of the rivers and so on. So I understand. I mean, sometimes EPA can do so much. I mean, I blame EPA, but at the same time, I also see the bigger context within which the agency works. I mean,
I want to ask you about an aspect of your book that is relevant to Wisconsin. You write, there was a 2004 EPA study of gas fracking, which involves hazardous chemicals forced underground at high pressure, and concluded that it posed little or no threat. Now, this is the actual fracking, it sounds like, not the frack sand mining, but that these chemicals at the time were found not to justify additional study. And you note that an official inside the EPA said that 5 of 7 members of the study panel had conflicts of interest.
Could you
tell us about that?
Yeah, this came to me through a colleague of mine who retired from EPA, and he spent all his life, 30 years, also working from the Denver office of the EPA. And he told me on the phone, and of course on the memo he wrote, He said that this is completely inappropriate. And of course, in 2005, when the Bush administration was in power, the Vice President Cheney, he collected all the representatives of the chemical, I mean, of the petrochemical industry, and they wrote a kind of energy policy in which they excluded EPA from having any impact or any control or any regulation on the water potential contamination because of fracking.
I'm just going to jump in here. So you said your colleagues said it was completely inappropriate, meaning what, that the chemicals used in fracking could pose a risk to the drinking water?
It was inappropriate because they the people who made that consideration, they had conflicts of interest. So they should not have been part of the decision-making process.
Mm. Okay, thank you. Let's go back to the callers now. David joins us in San Francisco. Hi, David.
Yes, hi. I'm sure appreciate the guest's courage. Obviously, when you start opposing the biggest of the, as far as I'm concerned, they're welfare cheats. These are polluters, and when you start looking at medical care, if cancer is being caused by pollution, but these polluters are not paying our medical bills, now we see the entire country is torn up about the high cost of medical bills. And this is totally caused by the polluters. So obviously your guest is he's not tilting at windmills, but he's certainly opposing some of the biggest of the welfare cheats. You know, I wanted to ask him specifically about whether or not these chemicals in law, whether these chemicals are now being considered innocent until proven guilty. And, you know, this is very significant in that as a human, I would love to have my civil rights protected in that way. But if lead is known to be a carcinogen or causing brain injury or something
gotcha,
like that.
Gotcha, David. So you're saying that that maybe for chemicals they should be guilty and until proven innocent, the other way around. What do you think of that, E.G.?
Yeah, most of the chemicals today, we have around 80,000 chemicals in the United States. In other words, the whole population of the country is more or less bathed in chemicals, unfortunately. Most of those chemicals have never been tested for either human or ecological effects. Now, the chemicals we're talking about, pesticides, for instance, there is a law that says you have to prove that the chemical that you want to register or the government approve it, it does not cause, quotation, unreasonable adverse effects on man and the environment, end of quote. But to prove that, I already hinted that the process is contaminated. I mean, it's there's a lot of fraud in that process. So, however, the other chemicals which are already in trade and they have not been tested, yes, the guess was correct. You almost have to prove. That is, EPA has to prove the chemical is causing a lot of damage before you actually remove it from the trade.
And, E.G., we've got about 30 seconds left here, but now that you've written this book and you've sort of sounded the alarm, what would you like people and politicians to do about the EPA?
Politicians especially have to redesign EPA to be completely isolated from the political influences that are so deleterious to its existence. That is, we have to redesign and rewrite a law. For instance, the president can nominate an administrator for 10 years, for instance, but then the administrator would be able to appoint his own deputies, not the president. So make it like a Federal Reserve kind of institution. And then prohibit by law any kind of lobbying by industry, by the White House and Congress. If you do that, then that agency will be able to begin to protect us from this deleterious stuff that is all over us.
E.G., thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to E.G. Vellianos, the author of Poison Spring, The Secret History of Pollution and the EPA. He spent 25 years working for the agency.